Welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 537 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the series on the free 120 for step 2CK. I am going to be going through questions 101 to 110. Again, if you've missed any other part of the series, I will encourage you to go back and go through it. I think you're going to find it to be very helpful. Let's get right to it. Question 101. A 25-year-old premigravid woman at 28 weeks gestation comes to the office for a routine prenatal visit. At 18 weeks gestation, she had vaginal bleeding that resolved spontaneously. At that time, her blood group was determined to be ORH negative and she received Rho-D immune globulin. She reports good fetal movement. Blood pressure is 120 over 70. Fetal heart rate is 160. Fundal height is 30. The fetus is in a vertex position. Hemoglobin concentration is 11 grams per deciliter and hematocrit is 34%. Serum antibody assay is positive. The anti-D titer is too weak to measure. Results of serologic testing for syphilis and HIV antibody testing are negative. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in management? Option A says to repeat serum anti-D antibody titer. Option B says ultrasonography of the pelvis. Option C says administration of Rho-D immune globulin. Option D says amniocentesis. And option E says induction of labor. So if you look at this question, this lady appears to be in her third trimester. And, you know, during her pregnancy, she had spontaneous vaginal bleeding and being Rh negative, which makes sense. They gave her Rho-D immune globulin. Remember, people that are Rh negative, we love to give them Rho-Gam at 2 times during pregnancy. We like to give it at 28 weeks. And we like to give it within the first 3 days after the baby has been delivered, within the first 72 hours. You can also give it at other times where you're kind of worried or concerned that mom was exposed to Rh positive blood. So pretty much any time mom bleeds out of the ordinary during pregnancy. So say, for example, she's in a trauma and she gets a blood transfusion and maybe mistakenly got Rh positive blood, or she just has vaginal bleeding or something like that during pregnancy, or she's getting like an amniocentesis. I know an amniocentesis doesn't involve bleeding, but there's the potential for mixing between mommy's blood and baby's blood. So just kind of keep in mind that there are some unusual times where a woman may get Rho-Gam that is outside of that 28-week and 72-hour postpartum period. So for this one, I think I'm going to go ahead and go with option C. This woman should certainly get Rho-D immune globulin. Now, I know some people may have been confused that, oh, wait, the anti-D titer is too weak to measure. So maybe they found something. I almost feel like that term or that small sentence is put there just to kind of mess with people's minds. Most of this question, this woman doesn't seem to be having much of anything going on. Don't overthink this thing. Go ahead and pick option C. She's at 28 weeks. She should get Rho-Gam because she is Rh negative. Remember, if you're Rh positive, you have no business getting Rho-Gam. But if, for example, the anti-D titer was very, very strong, then yes, in that situation, you should also not give Rho-Gam either. All right. So question 102 says, a 5-year-old boy is brought to the office by his parents in July because of a 2-day history of an itchy rash. The rash began as small red bumps on the right forearm and spread to the left cheek and right ankle within the same day. He has not had fever, vomiting, or diarrhea. No other family members have similar symptoms. Medical history is unremarkable and he receives no medications. The family switched to a new brand of bath soap last week. They have 3 pet cats and 1 dog. 3 days ago, the family attended a picnic at a nearby park. The temperature is 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, pulse is 90 per minute, and respirations are 20 per minute. The patient is alert and scratching his right forearm. Examination shows mild edema of the left cheek. A photograph of the right forearm is shown. Similar lesions are noted over the left cheek and right ankle. The remainder of the examination shows no abnormalities. Avoidance of which of the following is most likely to have prevented this patient's condition? So option A says dog, B says flora, C says peanut butter, D says perfumed bath soap, and E says sun. So if we look at all these things, and of course the MDMEs, they give you multiple problems here. And we see that in the family, they switched to a new brand of bath soap. But that was last week. The thing that you just see that, man, okay, they went to the park, it looks like. Let's see. Yes. So they went to a park recently, like 3 days ago. That just seems to be the one that is closest to when his symptoms began. So that park is probably the key to his problems. They've had these animals in the family for a long time. So I'm not going to go with option A. Peanut butter is not even mentioned in the question. So I'm going to skip that. That usually will cause anaphylaxis, if anything. That's a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction. You're not going to have anaphylaxis for 2 days. Perfume bath soap. Everybody in the family got that bath soap. They've been on it for days. I'm not too concerned. And again, they put option E to make you think of a sunburn. But again, if you have a sunburn, I would hope it comes fairly quickly after you were exposed to the sun. They went to the park 3 days ago. That doesn't make any sense. And if you look at this image, this sounds an awful lot like poison ivy. So I'm going to go with option B, flora. Basically, it's the stuff that exists in the environment. This child has poison ivy. Remember, it's like a delayed hypersensitivity reaction. It's almost like a kind of contact dermatitis. So typically, people that have these things, supportive care is really all they need. But you can use topical steroids. You can use calamine lotion. That's perfectly fine with these kids. But this child is going to be fine. So again, remember, it's a delayed type hypersensitivity reaction. It's a type 4 hypersensitivity reaction. All right. Now, we're going to go to question 103. Again, one of these HPI studies. These HPI studies, again, skimming them is not a bad idea. But this person is 56. They're coming to the clinic. It's female. She says she feels tired and doesn't feel well. And she's had fatigue in the legs for 3 months, tires quickly with physical activity. She has early satiety. She has hypertension and hyperlipidemia. She's on a thiazide diuretic, clothalidone, an ACE inhibitor, and a statin. If we look at her vitals, the only thing that jumps out at me is her blood pressure is a little bit elevated, 139 over 78, and BMI is 36, so she's obese. And then if we look at the physical examination, nothing really, really, really crazy sticks out at me. You know, abdominal exam may be a little abnormal, but I don't really care much about that. And then if we look at her blood studies, though, that's where the meat is. So her white count is really high. And a lot of it is neutrophils. And then you see all these other blood elements, these myeloid elements elevated. Myelocytes, metamyelocytes, basophils, eosinophils. This is going to be pretty classic, especially in a middle-aged person. I'm going to be going with a CML here. This person certainly has CML. This person certainly has a CML. This person absolutely has CML. So, again, what are the key facts here that tell us that this is CML? Just a couple of things, right? So, number one, we see that the person is middle-aged. Number two, we see the person's white count is elevated. And you see it's mostly myeloid cells, right? You see neutrophils, myelocytes, metamyelocytes, basophils. Basophilia is a very classic symptom or blood finding in people that have CML. And remember, CML is caused by this 922 translocation. So the B-cell receptor is translocated with ABL. And then your myeloid cells proliferate like crazy. And that can cause problems. And how do we manage CML? Well, managing CML with drugs like there are tyrosine kinase inhibitors like imatinib, dasatinib, nilotinib. There are many different tyrosine kinase inhibitors you can use to manage this stuff. And the one thing I'm going to say here is that CML, remember that translocation creates that Philadelphia chromosome. Looking at the other answers, option E talks about MGUS, the monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance. It's almost like a precursor to multiple myeloma. In fact, about 1% of people that have MGUS proceed to multiple myeloma every year. But the key thing here is that in MGUS, you're going to notice that they're going to have less than 10% plasma cells in their bone marrow. And they will not have the crap symptoms you see with multiple myeloma. They won't have hypercalcemia. They won't have renal failure. They won't have anemia. They won't have bone pain. And then if we look at the other answers, ALL, right? Remember, this is usually going to be a pediatric malignancy on the USMLEs. Don't get me wrong. Adults can certainly have ALL as well, but usually it's going to be in kids on your exams. And we tend to find it in people that have Down syndrome. Remember, Down syndrome, epicanthal folds, they can have endocardial cushion defects. They can have Hirschsprung's disease. Hirschsprung's disease is actually pretty classic in Down syndrome. So many times that Hirschsprung's disease will present with like chronic constipation. And you see these people, they're having like tons of stool in their colon. And they tell you that, oh, this person doesn't pass meconium early in life. So failure to pass meconium, that can actually be a presentation of Hirschsprung's disease on your exams. And then looking at AML. So AML, remember, there are many kinds of AML, but the one that the only one that they pretty much care about on the USMLEs is going to be acute promyelocytic leukemia. That's like the M3 subtype of AML. And that one tends to be associated with the 15-17 translocation. So you take the PML gene and you translocate it with the RARA, the retinoic acid receptor, aging. You have that translocation, and then that causes your myeloid blasts to proliferate like crazy. The thing is, these myeloid blasts in AML, they make a lot of pro-inflammatory cytokines, so like interleukin-1, interleukin-6, TNF-alpha and whatnot, and that can cause endothelial damage. When you damage the endothelium, you're going to trigger the coagulation cascade. And if you trigger the coagulation cascade, you're going to get in a lot of trouble. You're going to get in a lot of trouble with DIC, right? Remember, in DIC, all your platelet labs are out of whack. Your bleeding time is up, PT is up, PTT is up, D-dimer is elevated, fibrin degradation products elevated, fibrinogen is usually going to be decreased. Those are classic findings in DIC. And remember, don't forget, on a blood smear, make sure you can identify those hour rods. We see what acute promyelocytic leukemia, those hour rods. That's a classic blood smear that we see on the USMLEs. And again, we're going to treat this with all transretinoic acid. And one thing I want to say about ALL, in fact, many times when kids have ALL or people have ALL, they tend to get intrathecal chemotherapy because ALL has a predilection for the central nervous system. So many times chemotherapy is instilled into those people's spinal columns. And one thing I'll just say is before you start a person on therapy for CML, it's usually helpful to go ahead and check their QT interval, because these tyrosine kinase inhibitors, dasatinib and whatnot, they can certainly cause a person to have QT interval prolongation. So this is one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And also dasatinib is associated with proteinuria. So that's something I want to keep in mind with dasatinib. I remember dasatinib kind of sounds like the sunny water. That's a nice way to remember that. And then the final one I think I've not talked about here is CLL. CLL is usually going to be in older people. Their white count is going to be very, very high. But in contrast with CML, you're going to see an elevation in their lymphocytes. You're going to see a big lymphoid elevation. Big lymphoid elevation. That's the way you know that, oh, wait, I'm likely dealing with CLL. And those white cells don't work really great. So those people tend to be predisposed to a lot of infections. Okay, so question 104 says, a 65-year-old woman comes to the office because of a 6-month history of progressive shortness of breath and a 1-year history of non-productive cough. Initially, the shortness of breath occurred only with exertion, but now occurs at rest. It does not worsen when she lies down, but is still present. Her symptoms have limited her ability to travel internationally with the Peace Corps. She has not had chest pain, fever, chills, or blood-tinged sputum. She has hypertension, type 2 diabetes, and MDD. She's on amlodipine, lisinopril, glargine, and sertraline. She has smoked 1 pack of cigarettes daily for 50 years. Ahem. She drinks 1 glass of wine on special occasions. If you look at her vitals, everything is pretty okay. Pulse ox on room air shows an oxygen saturation of 94%. There's no JVD. On pulmonary examination, end expiratory wheezes are heard. There's a prolonged expiratory phase. Heart sounds are distant. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in diagnosis, right? So this person is pretty straightforward. This person seems like they have COPD. They have a 50-pack year smoking history. And we see that, you know, they're having like progressive shortness of breath, chronically worsening disorder. This is COPD. So for this, we're going to do PFTs. I'm going to go with option E here. I just want to make sure I supply the answers for the other one. So I said that for 103, pretty sure the answer is D, CML. For 102, the answer is flora. 101, the answer is C, given our RhoGAM. And then, so for 104, yeah, I'm going to do PFTs. This person certainly has COPD, right? So let's make some integrations with COPD. So let me ask you this real quick. So if a person has COPD, like emphysema, for example, which is probably what this lady has, what's going to be true of their PBGO2? So the oxygen tension in the alveoli, well, it's going to be low because the alveoli are just filled with so much CO2 that they are retaining. So their PBGO2 is going to be low. If your PBGO2 is low, what will be true of your PaO2? Well, PaO2 is the oxygen tension in your plasma. Since they don't have enough oxygen in the alveoli, then they're not going to be able to have enough to send to the plasma. So the PaO2 will be low as well. Okay, how about the PaCO2? Well, again, these people are CO2 retainers, right? So because they retain so much CO2, they're going to have a ton of CO2 measured in their bloodstream. So the PaCO2 is going to be increased. Okay, how about the SaO2? Remember, the SaO2 refers to the saturation of hemoglobin with oxygen. If you don't have enough blood in oxygen in your plasma, then you're not going to have enough diffusing on hemoglobin to saturate it appropriately. So your SaO2 is going to be decreased. Now, what's going to be true of your AA gradient? Well, again, these people have a cause of hypoxia, and the problem is within the lungs. The problem is literally within the lungs. This person has COPD, probably has emphysema. That's going to mess up because of all those proteases. They're going to chew up your pulmonary parenchyma. They're going to chew up the surface area they use for diffusion. So you're going to have inefficient diffusion of oxygen from your alveoli to your pulmonary vessels. So that's going to decrease, that's going to raise the AA gradient. Actually, it's going to raise the AA gradient because you're not going to have equilibration between the oxygen saturation, oxygen tension in your alveoli versus your pulmonary vessels. So your AA gradient is going to go up. Your DLCO, right? Your diffusion capacity for carbon monoxide is going to be decreased. Again, these people have reduced surface area because of those proteases that have chewed up the pulmonary parenchyma. And again, since there's so much, they don't have as much oxygen in their alveoli, in their plasma, on hemoglobin, their blood oxygen content is certainly going to be low. I won't be sure of these people's hematocrit. Well, I hope you're saying, oh, divine, this is going to be elevated. Because again, these people have chronic hypoxia from their COPD. That's going to cause their EPO to go up. EPO is going to cause them to have polycythemia. This is going to be a very good example of a polycythemia with an elevated EPO. I won't be sure of their bicarb. Well, again, these people are CO2 retainers. If you retain CO2, you're going to have a respiratory acidosis. Your body is going to try to compensate for that by causing a metabolic alkalosis. So your kidneys are going to make more bicarb ion. So you're going to have an increase in your bicarb. All right. Now, question 105 says, a 45-year-old man comes to the office because of a 6-month history of difficulty sleeping, nervousness, and fatigue. He goes to bed at 11 p.m. every night, falls asleep within 15 minutes, then sleeps fitfully. After he awakens, he has mild neck pain and feels tired, edgy, and tense during the rest of the day. The company where he worked for 27 years closed 6 months ago, and he has been unable to find another job. He says he worries about his finances and job prospects. Medical history is remarkable for alcohol use disorder. He has not drunk alcohol for 1 year. He says he is committed to being sober, but recently has wanted a drink. He currently takes no medications. Vital signs are within normal limits. Physical examination discloses no abnormalities. Mental status examination shows a constricted anxious affect. Which of the following is the most appropriate pharmacotherapy? So what does this person have? You see, this has been going on for 6 months. Remember, with psych questions, you always want to know your time frames, right? That's always a kind of a smart thing to do. So it's been going on for 6 months, and this person seems to be worried about a ton of stuff. So this seems a lot to me like generalized anxiety disorder. So remember, GED, you got to have your symptoms for at least 6 months. You're worried about so many things in life. So this is GED, and we're going to manage that first line with an SNRI. Let's see, are there any SSRI answers here? No. So we're not going to do that because there's no SSRI answer here. So what can we jump to? We're going to go to the second line treatment, which is buspirone. Buspirone is a partial agonist at serotonin receptors that we use to manage generalized anxiety disorder. It's a second line treatment for generalized anxiety disorder. So, but remember, the first line treatment is in fact an SSRI, but that's not an answer. So looking at these other answers, clonazepam is a benzo. Remember, diphenhydramine is an antihistamine, but it has very powerful anticholinergic properties. It's used for so many things on the USMLEs, although they like to test it a lot in terms of the side effects, right? So remember, it has anticholinergic properties, so it can cause problems like urinary retention. So your post-void residual volume will actually be elevated, and it can cause delirium, it can cause altered mental status. And remember, chronic use of these anticholinergic drugs like diphenhydramine is associated with Alzheimer's disease, which makes sense because in Alzheimer's, people usually have a deficiency of acetylcholine. Option D is a TCA, imipramine, that's a tricyclic antidepressant. Remember, tricyclic antidepressants, they cause a bunch of problems, right? So they have antihistaminergic effects, so they can cause sedation. They have anti-alpha-1 effects, so they can cause orthostatic hypotension. They have anti-muscarinic effects, so they can cause many of these urinary retention, delirium, and whatnot. But remember that your TCAs also block sodium channels. They are sodium channel blockers. They can work, in a sense, like a class 1 antiarrhythmic. By being able to work that way, they can cause a widening of your QRS complex because you have depolarization that just takes longer. Because remember, the sodium channels are involved in depolarization. So, and the QRS complex represents depolarization on an EKG, so of the ventricles at least. So because they're blocking sodium channels, depolarization is taking longer, your QRS is going to get wider. And remember, we're going to treat that with a sodium bicarb to overcome that sodium channel blockade. Option E, so this EKG that you see in the worksheet is showing a wide QRS. So that's going to be up. It's going to match with option D very, very well here. And then don't forget that quetiapine is an atypical antipsychotic. Temazepam is a benzo. That's all I'm going to say here. All right, so let's go to question 106. So a 56-year-old man comes to the clinic with his wife because of a 6-month history of restlessness while sleeping. The wife says he motions as if he were throwing or kicking a ball and sometimes punches the pillow during the night. He has hit her twice. Recently, he began talking in his sleep and yelling expletives. Occasionally, he seems to be acting out a dream. Twice, he has awakened and could tell his wife what the dream was about. Otherwise, he is unaware of these episodes and feels well rested in the mornings. He has a history of constipation treated with polyethylene glycol. He takes no other medications. Vital signs are within normal limits. Examination shows no abnormalities. The patient is at greatest risk for developing which of the following? This is one of those things where you either know the association or you don't know it. There's no way around it. But you see a person and they've had like years before they start having their neurologic disease. I'm trying to be vague here to kind of give you a presentation. You notice that they have like anosmia. They have like chronic, they have a lot of constipation. You see that they act out a lot of their dreams. That's pretty classic for Parkinson's disease. You can see people that have Parkinson's disease having those three symptoms before, years before they even have Parkinson's: constipation, anosmia, acting out dreams. So the answer here is going to be E. Remember, when a person has Parkinson's disease, we're going to manage it with carbidopa-levodopa. Remember, carbidopa levodopa have an association with people developing like compulsive behaviors like gambling, hypersexuality, and things of that nature. So you see a person, you know, they are being treated for a neurologic disease and then they go like on a spending spree or they start saying inappropriate things. They'll try to trick you on your exam, telling you that, oh, they've developed frontotemporal dementia. No, that's just carbidopa levodopa toxicity kind of showing forth. So the answer here is going to be E. So I'm not going to go with narcolepsy. Narcolepsy is more of a sleep disorder. They tend to just fall asleep on a whim. They go straight into REM sleep. This is not a stroke, right? This person doesn't seem to have any risk factors for strokes. Remember, the biggest risk factor for a stroke is hypertension. This person does not have a history of hypertension. ALS, they're usually going to have a lot of motor neuron problems. It's an upper and lower motor neuron disease. Just not many things here. Alzheimer's disease, again, is more of dementia. To be honest with you, I'm just going to say this. This question, there's no way you can get it right without knowing the association. That's all I'm going to say there. All right, let's go to question 107. So a 77-year-old woman is brought to the ED by her son because of a 3-day history of pain in her right wrist. The patient has advanced dementia, Alzheimer type, and is unable to provide her medical history. She's completely dependent on her son, with whom she lives, and who is her only caregiver. The son says he's unaware of any trauma to the patient's wrist. The son says the patient has no other history of serious illness. Only medication is memantine. That's an NMDA receptor antagonist that can be used to manage Alzheimer's. That's more like a second line. Remember, in Alzheimer's, we're going to start off with the acetylcholinesterase inhibitors like donepezil, galantamine, or rivastigmine. She is nonverbal and has a flat affect. She appears unkempt and to have poor hygiene. If we look at her vitals, they're completely okay. Her blood pressure is up, actually 150 over 90. The patient moans when the physician touches her right wrist. Examination shows multiple bruises over both forearms and wrists. The remainder of the examination shows no abnormalities. X-ray of the right wrist shows a distal radial fracture. The fracture is treated with cast immobilization. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in management? Sounds like this woman is being abused. So we're going to contact Adult Protective Services. This is a pretty easy question. You see an elderly person. Usually it's going to be people with dementia, people that are bedbound, people that depend on other people for help. And then you notice all these bruises on them and the person doesn't see much. That's going to be elderly abuse. So we're going to go ahead and contact Adult Protective Services. All right. Let's go to question 108. So a 27-year-old man comes to the emergency department because of a 4-week history of progressive shortness of breath and swelling of the lower extremities. During this time, he has also had shortness of breath during the night while lying down. He also has a 6-month history of intermittent moderate substernal chest pain and pressure while exercising. He has not had syncope. He has no history of serious illness and takes no medications. If you look at his vitals, he is tachycardic, he is hypertensive, he is tachypneic. Examination shows severe diffuse gingivitis. Crackles are heard halfway up the posterior lung basis bilaterally. On cardiac examination, a prominent S3 is heard. So that means this person has systolic heart failure. There's 3+ pitting edema of the lower extremities. ECG shows sinus tachycardia. Which of the following is the most likely substance used? So we see this person, they're hypertensive. They've developed heart failure. They have gingival problems, so problems with the tooth, with the mouth. This is pretty classic, right? It's going to be meth. This is meth. So I'm going to go with option D here. So this person has meth toxicity. Remember, meth kind of works like cocaine in a sense. So you can increase the catecholamines at your synapses, and that can cause you to have hypertension. All those catecholamines, they can stimulate alpha-1 receptors, and that can cause vasoconstriction. So you can have coronary vasoconstriction that can cause cardiac ischemia. Whenever you have cardiac ischemia, myocardial cells are going to start dying. They're going to start dying. And if your myocardial cells die, then your heart is not going to be able to pump blood effectively. You're going to develop a systolic heart failure. And the death of those myocardial cells, as your myocardial cells fail to contract well, volume, fluid is just going to keep accumulating within your heart. That chronic volume overload can cause your sarcomeres to be added eccentrically, added in series. Again, that can cause you to have a dilated cardiomyopathy. So this person has meth. I know some of you may be like, wow, Divine, why is it not cocaine? The thing is, could it be cocaine? Yes, cocaine can also cause a cardiomyopathy. But the thing is, we see this person having the severe diffuse gingivitis. Those mouth problems tend to be more meth associated. Looking at these other answers, right? Remember, toluene can cause sudden cardiac death. You're going to see these people that just, the people inhale toluene, they sniff it because it can cause a euphoria. But the thing is, toluene messes up a person's brain, messes up a person's kidneys, messes up a person's heart. So many times you can see them have a nasty cardiac arrhythmia that can cause sudden death. They can have like renal problems. So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind. That's usually pretty classic with toluene. And then heroin, right? That's an opioid. So it's going to cause respiratory depression. So the person's going to be super hypoxic. But remember, it's not like your lungs are bad. It's just that the heroin tells your brain to, tells you to not breathe, basically. So the person's lungs are completely fine. So they'll be hypoxic because they're not breathing enough. They have like profound respiratory depression. But they're going to have a normal AE gradient because oxygen can diffuse just fine in their lungs. Their pulmonary architecture is completely okay. Now, can lead to a polymorphic ventricular tachycardia. I remember methadone. We use it for opioid rehab. It's kind of like a weaker opioid, but obviously you can prolong your QT interval. And that's why you want to be sure that a person doesn't have a prolonged QT when you're starting them on methadone. This person probably, if you put a person on methadone, it can prolong the QT interval, and that can lead to torsade de pointe. Remember, another name on the exams for torsade de pointe is polymorphic LVTEC. And remember, for torsade de pointe, we're going to manage that with magnesium. Now, one other thing I want to say about methadone, right? So, we use it in opioid rehab. Does it make sense to put a person that is on methadone on naltrexone? It doesn't make any sense, right? Because naltrexone is also used to treat some addictive disorders. So if you put that person, they're already on methadone, you put them on naltrexone. Naltrexone is a mu receptor antagonist. It's going to reverse the methadone. You're going to throw them into opioid withdrawal. That doesn't seem like a very smart idea, does it? Okay, so I think we've kind of hit most of the major points here. So I think I'm going to go ahead and continue. So question 109. So a 39-year-old man comes to the office because of a 3-month history of episodes of headaches, palpitations, and sweating. Episodic headache, palpitations, and sweating. I would hope that you kind of know what's going on with that. The episodes occur 2 to 3 times monthly. He has hypertension treated with a calcium channel blocker and an ACE inhibitor. His blood pressure is 166 over 112. Examination shows no other abnormalities. A CT scan of the abdomen shows a 4-centimeter left adrenal mass. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in management? So we'll see a person with episodic headache, hypertension, palpitation, sweating. This is pretty classic for a pheochromocytoma. So we're going to check the plasma, metanephrines, non-metanephrines. So we're going to go to option D for that. Let's look at the other answers here, though. Option A, 24-hour urine collection for measurement of von Leo-Mendelic acid. Sure, but I don't like the second half of that answer. 5-hydroxyindole-acetic acid, that's 5-HIAA. That's what we measure levels of to screen a person for carcinoid syndrome. Well, this person does not have carcinoid syndrome, so we're going to cross out option A. Remember, carcinoid syndrome, you have a mass making a ton of serotonin. Usually it's going to be in the appendix, but and usually it's not going to cause any symptoms, because if it's in the appendix, it makes the serotonin, liver breaks it down, we're all happy. But once it spreads to the liver, once you have mets to the liver, then you're going to start having problems, because that serotonin is, if you've bypassed the liver, it can cause right-sided heart problems. So it can cause like tricuspid insufficiency. It can cause pulmonic stenosis. You can see a lot of wheezing, bronchospasm in carcinoid syndrome. And remember, people who have carcinoid also tend to be flushed. They tend to have like a lot of diarrhea. Just something to kind of keep in mind. So this person doesn't have carcinoid syndrome. I'm going to get rid of that. Adrenal venous sampling is something that we sometimes do in Kahn syndrome management. This person doesn't have Kahn syndrome. They don't have primary hyperaldosteronism. So we're going to skip that. Option C is something you may do to treat again. Like an adrenal. Option C kind of seems like something you may do as a treatment measure. But like, gee, we've not figured out. Let's figure out what's going on with this guy first before we start treating, right? So we said the right answer is option D. And option E, transsphenoidal hypophysectomy. That's a surgical procedure we use for pituitary adenomas. Although remember, usually like if a person has a prolactinoma, which is probably the most common kind of like functional pituitary adenoma, we're going to manage that with dopamine agonists like bromocriptine or cabergoline. We almost never do surgery for people that have a prolactinomas. But there are other kinds of pituitary adenomas that we definitely do surgery for, right? Like a pituitary adenoma that's making like growth hormone, you can certainly do a transsphenoidal hypophysectomy. You know, before surgery, for those people, you can say, oh, fine, let's put you on octreotide, or let's put you on pegvisomant. Pegvisomant is a growth hormone receptor antagonist. But just in general, you can do surgery for those people, transsphenoidal surgery. I believe I've actually seen one of those back in the day. So like a growth hormone secreting tumor. So how will a growth hormone secreting tumor present? Well, remember, growth hormone is a diabetogenic hormone. So you're going to see this person having like a very high fasting blood glucose, and it causes visceromegaly. So many of your organs are going to get big. So you can have heart failure. You'll see increased spacing between the teeth. The hearts don't fit anymore, blah, 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 blah. And typically you're going to work that stuff up by checking the person's IGF-1 levels. Because remember, growth hormone, the secretion is kind of weird. So you cannot depend on those levels to say, oh, I'm going to screen you for a growth hormone secreting tumor like that. No, you're going to measure the IGF-1 levels. You're going to notice they're elevated. And then after that, you're going to do an oral glucose suppression test. Remember, whenever you have tumor in endocrinology. Or whenever you have a disorder in endocrinology associated with hypersecretion of something, the confirmatory test is really going to be some kind of suppression test. I've talked about this schema many times in different podcasts. Like if a person has like primary hyperaldosteronism, Kahn syndrome, they're making a ton of aldosterone. Well, you can do like a saline infusion test. Because you give the person saline, it raises their blood volume, and you want to see if the aldosterone suppresses. So those suppression tests are good for hypersecretive tumors. So for a growth hormone tumor, because it's a diabetogenic hormone, give the person a glucose load and see if their growth hormone suppresses. That's how you confirm actually the diagnosis of growth hormone secreting tumor. Obviously, if you're less than 18, that's gigantism. More than 18 is going to be, we're going to call that acromegaly. All right. So let's go to the final question here, question 110. So a 41-year-old woman is being prepared for a discharge from the hospital after treatment for acute pancreatitis. She has tolerated oral fluids well for the past 12 hours. She has had 3 prior admissions for pancreatitis. Medical history also is remarkable for alcohol use disorder. The patient does not have secure housing. Which of the following recommendations is most likely to reduce this patient's risk for future hospital admission? So option A says abstinence from alcoholic beverages. Option B says enrollment in a health insurance plan. Option C says nutritional counseling. Option D says placement in a women's shelter. This person has acute pancreatitis. She has alcohol use disorder. Alcohol causes pancreatitis. Stop drinking and the pancreatitis will go away. We're going to go to option A here. Don't overthink this thing. Remember, there are many other causes of pancreatitis you may see on your exams. Mumps, hypertriglyceridemia. There are many drugs that can cause pancreatitis. Like the Ozempic-like drugs, the GLP-1 agonists, the DPP-4 inhibitors. Those can cause pancreatitis. There are many drugs that can cause pancreatitis. Remember, if you smash your belly on like a handlebar or whatever, that can also cause you to have a pancreatitis, like a traumatic pancreatitis. Gallstones can also cause pancreatitis. There are many things that can cause pancreatitis on the exam. So I think we should stop here. I hope you, so I'll encourage you, there's a worksheet included with this podcast. So just, I will tell you to pre-read the worksheet before you listen to the podcast. And then after you can do one of two things. You can either fill out the worksheet as you listen to the podcast or use the worksheet as a quiz after you listen to the podcast. Basically, these worksheets are designed for you to be able to answer all the questions if you listen to the podcast closely. If you listen to the podcast closely, all the answers to the questions are in the podcast. So that's all I'm going to say there. So as I wrap up, I offer classes for step 1 to step 3. They start next week, Tuesday. And if you're interested in any of those, I've made a separate podcast where I talk about those. So if you go on my website, you see the dates and times. They're all over Zoom. The classes are not lectures. They're all clinical scenarios, MBME style questions that I use to make integrations and explain pathophase. So I'm not a person that's just going to be dumping info on you. No, I'm going to explain the material to you. I'm going to explain pathophase. I'm going to help you make integrations. And I'm going to show you how they test things on the exams. That's one thing many people lose sight of in preparing for these tests. And then I offer one-on-one tutoring. And I have these podcasts on the major platforms, Apple, Google, Spotify. I have a YouTube channel you can check out. And I also help with ERAS applications and personal statements and rec letters and things of that nature. And then I have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Every week I post about 2 podcasts where from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson. So DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you in the next episode. I guess that'll be 538. So God bless you. Have a wonderful weekend and bye for now. Thank you.